From the City of Angels near the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM. Later on tonight, we'll talk about the power of your dreams. Here's what's happening. Well, the Ford Motor Company is going to lay off 12,000 workers in Europe because they want to introduce new vehicles, more electric. It's a major change. And of course, 12,000 jobs in Europe, that's huge. North Korea has issued new warnings to the United States, blasting recent statements by the Secretary of State, Mike Pompeo, and threatening military action if diplomacy between Washington and North Korea continues to falter. In a statement from North Korea's foreign ministry, they said the U.S. viciously slandered the country, citing the recent release of State Department reports about human trafficking and religious freedom that rank North Korea very poorly. So we shall see what happens there. Is humanity doomed? We certainly don't lack a little apocalyptic scenarios. Nuclear war, a robot uprising, climate change, unlikely, far-fetched, Well, not according to scientists and mathematicians who in recent decades have found a surprising new source for anxiety about the long-term survival of the human race. Probability theory, the so-called doomsday argument, holds that there is a 50% chance that the end of human life would come within 760 years. There's only one person that I could turn to get their reaction to this story, and that's Howard Bloom. Howard, 760 years? What do you think?
The Wall Street Journal carried an article today, and its headline made a shocking claim. And this it said, doomsday math says humanity may have just 760 years left. Now, the man who wrote this article, William Poundstone, attended MIT and wrote a biography of Carl Sagan, so he seemed to have a few scientific chops. And his doomsday claims, one of space in Vanity Fair and a host of online sites, including Reddit, ValueBit, Tiger Droppings, Los Angeles County Museum on Fire, and Zenith News. But Poundstone's claim is, in my opinion, utter bunkum, totally fallacious. But it's headline-grabbing bunkum. Why? Us humans have a deep emotional instinct that's triggered by visions of the end of the world. Two of the world's leading religions began as apocalypse cults. One predicted that the world would end in the Day of Judgment, that's Islam. The other predicted a fiery apocalypse followed by the Second Coming, and that Second Coming was supposed to happen any minute, that's Christianity. It's been close to 2,000 years, and the world hasn't yet ended in catastrophe, or a Second Coming, nor has it seen a fiery Judgment Day. The apocalypse predictions of the world's two greatest religions have not come true, yet the notion of coming catastrophe is addictive. It continues to glue together believers, and we now have a new catastrophe cult on the scene, the climate change movement. Now, why do visions of apocalypse have such a primal appeal? They grab us by the gut. We're like ants. When someone or something breaks through the walls of an ant colony, the ants at the scene send out an alarm pheromone, an alarm signal you can smell. Other ants drop everything they are doing and rush to the site of the break-in to gawk and to help in the repairs. An alarm signal is an efficient way to mobilize a crowd fast to handle an emergency, but it's not good science. The prediction that humanity will end in 760 years is based, as you said, on probability theory, specifically on Bayesian mathematics. Bayesian math has proven to be wickedly effective. It's used by Google, Facebook, Apple, Amazon, and the artificial intelligence of self-driving cars. Mm-hmm. But the 760-year prediction, as Bayesian as it may be, is just plain wrong. In fact, most applications of the doomsday math have come up with very different answers than Poundstone's 760 years. Poundstone cites Princeton mathematician John Richard Gott III, but Gott's calculations say that humanity will end in between 50,000 years and 7.8 million years, not 760. Another application of the doomsday calculation has come up with a figure of 9,120 years. What's more, a look at the history of other species shows that creatures tend to last a heck of a lot longer than Poundstone's 760 years. The dinosaurs were around for 180 million years. Insects have been here for 300 million years, and birds have been around for 65 million years. Now look, bacteria are our ancestors. Over a billion years ago, they brought utter disaster to the planet with their toxic pollution of the atmosphere. But those bacteria are still alive today. They're still with us. The toxic gas with which these bacteria destroyed their world and almost killed themselves off, is called oxygen. It's what you and I live on today. So in the real world, the world of nature, even catastrophes are opportunities in disguise.
I hope, Howard, you are right in that our civilization lasts much longer than a predicted 760 years. Now, I'm going to put this in the file of a sicko father. A Wisconsin man punched and killed his five-year-old son after he got angry that the child had eaten his Father's Day cake. What's wrong with people? These are real stories. NASA is eyeing up a nearby asteroid that contains enough gold to make everyone on Earth a billionaire. It's called Psyche 16. It's nestled between the orbits of Mars and Jupiter. It's made of solid metal as well as gold. The mysterious object is loaded with heaps of platinum, iron, and nickel as well. Go get that asteroid. A mysterious fast radio burst has been traced to a galaxy 3.6 billion light years away. We don't know what it all means, but that's a pretty good story. What else is going on in the skies? Let's check in with Peter Davenport from the National UFO Reporting Center. Hey, Peter.
Well, good evening, George. And I'd like to start off my report tonight by revisiting a subject I talked about last week, and that's these very peculiar high-altitude balloons or presumed balloons that people are seeing all across the United States.
Sure.
Last week, they had been seen in Ohio, Indiana, Illinois, Missouri, Colorado, Nebraska, California, and New Mexico. And I certainly cannot call them UFOs, but I think it's premature to call them balloons, principally because nobody seems able to identify either the government agency or the company that's put them up. It's a very strange phenomenon, and one of the peculiarities of it is that these objects, when viewed from the ground, appear to be hovering motionless for up to 2 hours of time. And I can't figure out how you can get a balloon in the stratosphere, where I presume it is, to hover motionless. Also, it's very peculiar that nobody seems able to find what are called NOTAMs, or Notice to Airmen, put out by the FAA for obstructions or impediments to navigation. So it's a continuing mystery, despite what a lot of people have said. And if anybody out there in the audience knows what these objects are, I would welcome a contact, and we'll try to get to the bottom of it. On the subject of reports, first one comes from the U.S. Navy, George, your old haunting grounds. A gentleman writes that he was able to reconstruct the exact date of a sighting in the Eastern Mediterranean. December 16, 1997, he was a radar operator aboard a P-3 Orion, a sub hunter, and about 2 hours into the flight out of Italy they were flying, they picked up an object, the flight crew on the flight deck picked up an object visually that appeared to be approaching their aircraft very fast. It looked like a fuzzy ball of snowball, a snowball type object, and they called the radar operator, and he looked in his radar and he couldn't find it, but he turned on his forward-looking infrared radar, or infrared I guess you call it radar, and he could make it out clearly. He rushed up to the flight deck with the pilot and co-pilot, and he got a good eyeball on it. They have no idea what it was. And interestingly, George, in light of the Navy's changed policy on flight crews reporting UFOs, nobody on the crew reported it. Nobody on the crew wanted to report it.
Not this time.
Yeah. Next report comes from down in your neck of the woods. This is May 24th. I think it was a Wednesday. I'm not sure. The gentleman was riding on an airliner from San Jose down to LAX. Just as the airliner turned from base to final approach, flying to the east towards the airport, he saw, he claims, a spherical metallic-looking ball just go streaking by the airplane, saw it for only 2 or 3 seconds. He saw it well enough to be able to say that it was clearly metallic and it was clearly going very fast in addition to the forward movement of the airplane. Last report I'd like to introduce to the audience comes from Newark Airport. This is Monday of this week, Monday afternoon, 1:36 p.m. East Coast time, husband and wife were driving by Newark Airport on the New Jersey Turnpike, and they saw a very peculiar disc-shaped object intermixing with the aircraft on the ground preparing to take off. At my recommendation, she contacted the airport security, and they told her it was a drone. Well, I tend to disagree with that assessment, George. People are too readily trying to force these objects that people are reporting into the drone mold. In any event, it flew off and remains unidentified. She said that one aircraft, an Israeli aircraft, she thinks a 767, was just taking off, and it appeared to bank very suddenly to avoid the object.
Hmm.
So there's a lot going on, and we'll keep the audience, Coast audience, apprised of new developments in the future.
We'll talk to you next week with your reports. Thank you. Peter Davenport from the National UFO Reporting Center. Well, a week ago, I saw a story that Russia intends to start flying planes close to U.S. territory. And then all of a sudden, another story. Russia sends warships to Havana in a message to the United States. They're trying to bring additional troops to Venezuela to protect Maduro there. But what's this all mean? There's a deeper story. So I told our executive producer, Lisa Lyon, Lisa, get a hold of Stephen Cohen for us. It's time we talk about Russia, because things to me are getting very tense. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you. This may be one of the most important couple hours you have heard in a long, long time. First of all, a person that I think may be one of the best experts on Russia, Stephen Cohen's joining us. Professor of Russian Studies, History Emeritus at NYU, Professor of Politics Emeritus at Princeton. He's among the most distinguished scholars of Russian history in the United States. He is internationally recognized for his academic works on Russia and Soviet political history, going way back to 1917 of work, not his work, but the political history. Cohen is also an expert on Russian-American relations and has for decades contributed both domestically and abroad in shedding light on the two countries' political and historical relationship. Stephen, welcome back.
That's pretty funny what you said, George, because the other day some young guy that I've kind of mentored said, how long have you been around anyway? And I think I said, I think since the Russian Revolution.
Just about.
He's been around since 1917.
Stephen,
almost, not quite.
I was a kid during the Cold War and the Cuban Missile Crisis back in 62.
Yeah.
I have never felt this concerned about U.S.-Russia relations that I do right now. How do you feel about this?
Well, you have had me. I've had the privilege, because it is a privilege to be on Coast to Coast, because I hear in the aftermath from people all around the country, including states where I have lived, I have said on your broadcast before, since we began, I think maybe 2 years ago was the first time,
yes,
that we are in a new Cold War. So you and I lived through the preceding Cold War. We were told in the 1990s by the Clinton administration and others that Cold War was over forever. I began arguing in the late 1990s we were headed for a new Cold War. People said I was wrong, but I think most people now agree that we are in a new Cold War with post-Soviet, post-communist Russia. But I have a second thesis that people not yet have accepted, that in various ways this new Cold War is more dangerous than the preceding one. So that's my ominous message, but it's urgent in my mind. It's important to discuss it, and very few people except you have let me discuss it with a national audience. And of course, the presidency of Donald Trump and the allegations, false I believe, against him regarding Russia have made everything worse. So I have to, as happy as I am to be with you again, I have to apologize that once again I'm the bearer of not good news. I hope one day you'll have me on and I'll have nothing but good news about our relations with Russia and with the world.
Let's hope so. But
we'll have it tonight.
But it's real, and that's what's so important right now. And the president and Vladimir Putin are in Japan as we speak, Stephen.
Yeah.
at the G20 summit, and they're going to be talking with, I'm convinced, a lot of things. But I want to get your reaction, first of all, to the situation of warships from Russia going to Cuba, a statement from Russia that we're going to be doing flybys near U.S. territory. Why are they starting to push and push?
Because we are in a new Cold War, and that's what Cold War looks like. You remember Reagan, who presided over, or thought he had, the end of the preceding Cold War. That's, I think, his claim to greatness, his attempt to end the Cold War with Gorbachev. You and I remember that.
Yep.
I don't know whether all your listeners remember the late 1980s the way you and I do. And by the way, I worked then on a retainer basis, not full time, while I was a professor for CBS News, and I went with them to a lot of these summit meetings.
And you got to know Gorbachev very well.
Very, very well. And in fact, I mean, I say this only because if we speak about Gorbachev, I can with some authority. I see him whenever I'm in Moscow. He's not well, but if I go out close to where he lives, because he doesn't like to drive too far, we always have dinner the night I arrive in a restaurant in a rustic area where his dacha or his house is. And of course he's sad because he believed, and it was said, that he, with Reagan and then with the first President Bush, had ended the Cold War.
I thought so too.
And that's not the case. And Gorbachev, when I began to tell him years ago Cold War was coming back, he got very angry at me because he thought I was challenging his historical legacy. Now, bear in mind that Gorbachev was born in March 1931, so he's 88, is that right?
Yeah.
He's an elderly man. I mean, I'm an old guy, but he's older than
me. And I think his son lives here in the United States, doesn't he?
No, he doesn't have a son. He has two daughters who live in Germany. For reasons that I don't want to talk about, but are not happy.
Okay.
Not happy about
all
that.
Right.
They and the grandkids live in Germany.
Now, part of me, as we look at what Putin is doing right now, Stephen, part of me thinks this is a ruse because, you know, Russia was accused of meddling in our election. They're accused of supporting Donald Trump. What a better way to have people confused than to pretend you're ticked off with the United States? Part of me thinks that's possible, is it?
You mean the things that Putin says?
Yeah.
No, he's not faking it. He's deeply disappointed. It may surprise your listeners, but when Putin came to power almost exactly 20 years ago in January 2000, he had a mission. And the mission was not only a mission he was given by the people who put him in power, it was a mission given to him by history. If I can speak in those terms. Russia, you will remember, George, was in ruins in 2000, in ruins, after the worst depression in peacetime had unfolded and just decimated Russia in the 1990s under Yeltsin. I mean, ruins. The middle class had lost its savings. Millions of people had been plunged into poverty. The country was coming apart at the seams. Control over its nuclear weapons was being strained. I mean, Putin came to power. He was always put in power. We don't have to go into the story. So, viewed in terms of history, Putin's mission was to pull Russia back together, to stabilize it, to get it back on its feet. And he's achieved that. Now, some people say he's gone too far. That's a separate issue.
By the way, it was Khrushchev's son that's living here, not Gorbachev.
All right, so that's right. Sergei Khrushchev is, I believe, a professor at Brown University, or at least was and lives up there. And he has been his father's historian and biographer and published quite a few books and memoirs about his father, Khrushchev. So you're absolutely right about that.
I knew it was one of them. But back to Putin again. So he's flexing his muscles, but this is what concerns me, Stephen, and I'm pretty sure it concerns you too. We're in a mess with Iran right now. We've got an administration that does not seem to back down on things they say, and I'm concerned of some kind of military conflict. But what really bothers me the most is Russia has developed an alliance with Iran. I don't think Putin is going to let this happen without some kind of involvement on their part.
Wait a minute. Now, you don't think Putin's going to let what happen?
I don't think he's going to let us fight with Iran. Well, and we're going to hit a break. Let's come back and talk about that. But I don't think Putin's going to let us battle Iran without Russia getting involved. We'll be back in a moment with Professor Stephen Cohen as we talk about U.S.-Russian relations. We'll take calls with Stephen next hour here on Coast to Coast AM. We are back with Professor Stephen Cohen. Stephen, right before the break, I was wondering, with the situation between the United States and Iran, and it doesn't seem to be getting any easier, Russia has an alliance with Iran. I'm not sure Putin's going to stand by and let us waltz into Iran or do whatever we have to do something.
I think that's the looming question today. Let me just briefly reset the conversation, the context.
Okay.
You mentioned that Russian warships were sailing into places like Venezuela. You mentioned that at the top of our conversation.
Yeah.
It's also the case that American and NATO warships are sailing very close to Russian waters in the Black Sea between Russia and Ukraine. And there have been some close encounters, not with UFOs, but between these NATO, American, and Russian warships. What is this? This is a sign of the new Cold War, because this happened during the preceding Cold War. Reagan, you may have recalled, when he was president, when asked about this sort of thing, famously said, "It takes two to tango."
Yep.
You remember that?
And he was right.
And what he was saying is that the two sides begin to imitate each other with these close encounters. But they're extremely dangerous because they could lead to some unintended military confrontation.
Yes.
So we've increasingly approached that situation. Now, I brought out, I think, 3 or 4 months ago, a new book. It's called War with Russia? And a good part of it reflects the conversations you and I have had, and it's written for general readers. But I mention it because the title is War with Russia? And in the introduction, I said that when I was writing the book, which would have went to press late last year, the book came out basically this year, I said that I had never written a book about Russia when I've been so worried about a war between my country, the United States, and Russia. That was 4 or 5 months ago that I wrote that, and I'm even more worried today. And I mention that so that we can now go to the question you raise rightly, and it's been on my mind, about Iran. So in Iran, we have what? We have a situation where the President of the United States, and we can discuss whether it's a good idea, is making war talk about Iran. Lots of threats.
Correct? Yes.
Meanwhile, for various reasons, geopolitical reasons, Russia, as you said, preempting what I would have said, you're very well informed, Russia has entered a de facto strategic alliance with Iran. This is partly the result of the Syrian war, but it also involves Israel. In fact, something very unusual happened. I'd never heard of it before. I think 3 or 4 days ago, the national security advisors, not the leaders, but the national security advisors of Russia, the United States, and Israel met in Jerusalem. So that would have been John Bolton, right?
Mm-hmm.
The Russian national security advisor and the Israeli one. And what they were talking about was the possibility of war in Iran. So we can ask, George, that if there is an American war with Iran, or even less, an American attack on Iran that doesn't develop into a full war, what will Russia do? Because that could be a trigger to an American-Russian war. Have I made myself clear and logical?
Absolutely. Now,
so it's a question mark, though, George. Let me just add, so that we know we got the whole picture in front of us. And again, I spell this out in my little book, War with Russia? It puts Putin very much on the spot. He's praying, if he prays, that this doesn't happen. But in Moscow, as you and I talk, this is being discussed, this possibility. One other point that we forgot to mention. I don't know what time it is in Japan. I meant to Google it and find out. But probably at this moment, as you and I are talking, or within the hours, Putin and Trump are meeting.
I think they're meeting. That's absolutely true. And right now it's 2:44 p.m. in Japan.
2:44 p.m. on the date of
Friday,
June 28th, correct?
Yep.
So they are meeting, I think, maybe right now. You and I are meeting, and they're meeting, and we're talking about them. They're probably not talking about us.
But, they may be talking about you.
No, but this isn't, I mean, the point I'm making is that we could hardly have a more topical discussion, because what they say to each other is of immense importance. And what Putin is going to want to ask Trump is that, is your talk, your warfare talk about Iran, just talk?
Is the president going to level with him and
wait a minute. And Trump is going to say to him, what are you going to do about it? What's going to be your reaction if I feel it's necessary to make a military strike on Iran? Now, they need to be candid with each other, because we're talking about the possibility of war. And, I mean, it's just weird. It's sort of, to me, it's strange that we're talking about this possibly as these two guys are talking about it at this very moment. Don't you find that a little freaky?
Absolutely. And here's the thing. You know, why isn't Putin concerned about Iran possibly developing nukes? And we are. Why can't everybody just seem to get along? What do we have these adversarial relations for?
So let me say, because maybe your listeners haven't thought about it, why Iran is important to Russia and therefore to Putin. Russia has been encircled by NATO, correct? We've moved NATO's military power all the way to Russia's western borders, from the Baltic region in the north, all the way down to Ukraine in the south. The one large neighbor, the two large neighbors, I should say, very large and important neighbors that Russia has that are not only not NATO countries, but anti-NATO countries, are China and Iran. So that's the first importance of Iran to Russia. The second importance, and I don't know if you and I have ever mentioned this before, George, Russia has approximately 17 million Muslim citizens of its own.
Yes, they do. You're right.
Russia's population is about 144 million, and about 17 million are believing, faithful Muslim citizens who have lived in Russia for centuries. Iran has never done anything to instigate, incite, arouse Russia's own Muslim citizens against Moscow. You understand how important that is to Russia. Therefore, Russia doesn't have a choice. It must have a good relationship with Iran. It has nothing to do with the United States. It's hard for Americans, because we think of ourselves as the center of the world, to put ourselves in the shoes and see through the eyes of major countries in other regions of the world. But Russia views Iran as a potential nightmare if for any reason it became anti-Russian. Do you follow me?
I sure do.
So this is not some theoretical minor issue that Putin is dealing with.
This is huge.
And the last thing he wants, to conclude my point, and again, if he prays, he must pray every night. It doesn't come to that. Is American war against Iran, because what is he going to do?
See, one, he has to show face. He's got to get involved, I think, to let Iran know that he's a tough guy and he's not going to let some country, the United States, walk all over them.
Well,
he has no choice.
It's more intense than that. Putin in the United States, in the media, is presented as an autocrat and a dictator who does what he wants and he's answerable to no one. That is not true. All major policy that Putin makes, whether domestic or foreign, is negotiated among powerful groups who have a vested interest in that policy. And there are people in Moscow, powerful groups, not only military and intelligence groups, who feel that whatever happens, if push comes to shove, Putin has to side with Iran against the United States. And there are other people who are more pro-Western who say that Putin must not do that. So Putin is caught in a domestic political vice of his own. You follow me?
And what about the wild card, China? Where do they fit in all of this?
So intellectually, ideologically, politically, but not yet militarily. China is on the side of Iran and Russia. The question is, and you're way ahead of me. I mean, I made some notes about things to mention. You're so far ahead of me, you should interview yourself, or I should interview you.
No, I can't give the answers you give.
Well, I mean, I can ask the question. Sometimes we don't know the answer, but it's the question behind the headline, and maybe tomorrow's headline or the day after will give us the answer. But what may be emerging, let me back up. We talk a lot in the United States about the American-led international order, right?
Yes.
It doesn't exist, if it ever did. If it did exist, it's fallen apart. What might be emerging in our lifetime, before our eyes, as we talk tonight, George? An alliance, think about this, between Russia, China, and Iran. Imagine the immense size.
Huge.
The population, the resources, and the geopolitical location of these three countries, Iran, Russia, and China. If that is emerging, and by the way, we might know the answer to this if Trump does something in the next week or two, it's preposterous to talk any longer about a U.S.-led world order. So you and I, our kids, and I've got some grandkids. I don't know about you.
I do. I'm about to become a great-grandfather.
Oh, my God. Well, you're ahead of me.
Jeez.
I'm older than you, but you've been more active.
I started early.
I started pretty early, but, well, anyway. The point here is that it's the Chinese say that it's a great blessing to live in interesting times. There's a saying, right? Interesting, though, can be a little too interesting, a little too traumatic. But we may be seeing, and our kids may be seeing, as we talk, George, the transformation of what we used to call the world order. Because imagine a world in which there is an economic, political, and military alliance between Russia, China, and Iran. Imagine that.
That's incredible.
Where is America? And where is Europe? When you think of the immense populations of these countries and the resources and the landmass, you know, by the way, just to show you how little we pay attention, that Russia has an enormously disproportionate amount of the world's natural resources. First and foremost, fresh water, which is becoming a precious commodity in the world. When we think of the resources these countries have, it should make us think about America's role in the world. And we can't get Washington. Trump, in his funny, idiosyncratic, maybe dysfunctional way, has talked about this. He's questioned NATO. He's questioned our alliances. But though he asked the question in a way that offends a lot of people, he is asking the right questions. We don't know if he's going to come up with the right answers. I'm happy that Trump has at least forced these questions to the best he can. Now, he's accused of treason for asking the questions.
Mm-hmm.
It's nonsense. But nobody else asks these questions except obscure academics. And then you get this blustering Donald Trump who comes forward and says, well, what's NATO do anyway in this world? And who's paying for it?
Yeah.
And then he goes off to places like North Korea. I mean, he's bashed. I listened to TV tonight. He's bashed for mating with Kim. They say, look at him coddling a dictator. But for decades, it was extremely dangerous that North Korea, with its nuclear weapons, be isolated from the international community. Trump has dragged North Korea into the community of nations. South Korea is very happy about this. Japan's not unhappy. But in Washington, they go on about, how can he do this? Kim is a dictator. Yeah, he's a dictator. He's a dictator loaded with nuclear weapons.
In 1962, during the Cuban Missile Crisis, Stephen, we had statespeople. We had Kennedy and Khrushchev who reasoned and worked this out, avoiding a worldwide catastrophe.
Yes.
Do we, politics aside, do we have statespeople like that today?
Well, we only have one potential statesman at a time. It's the President of the United States. That's the way our system is built. Foreign policy is made, and national security. Congress has a role to play. But Kennedy didn't go to Congress to solve the Cuban Missile Crisis. He went to his brother Bobby, right?
That's right.
So they worked it out in the White House, and they worked it out with Khrushchev, the leader of the Soviet Union at the time. And I have asked myself, and I've asked on your broadcast, and I address this question in my new book, War with Russia. What would happen, and people should think about this, if tomorrow or the day after there's a Cuban Missile-like crisis anywhere where we are eyeball to eyeball with Russia. Could be Syria, could be Ukraine, could be the North Baltic. We are eyeball to eyeball military with Russia in too many places. So what if push comes to shove, as it did in, or almost to shove, as it did in Cuba? And the two leaders have to do what Khrushchev and Kennedy did, avert nuclear war. We are on the same page so far.
You got it. Yep. All right. Yep.
I asked myself, and I've tried to ask people, and they said, Steve, shut up. We don't want to discuss it. Given what we've done to Trump with this crazy Russiagate business, which is all false, would Trump be free? Would we let him? Would the American media, would Congress let Trump negotiate with Putin to avert a nuclear war in a Cuban missile-like situation, whether it was in Ukraine or Syria?
We're going to have to.
Well, I don't know what that means, George. We're going to have to.
We have to let the president get this fixed. Politics aside, it's got to be done.
Will they?
I mean, that's a good question.
Well, Trump's driven the Washington establishment completely crazy. Are you aware, George, let's go back to today. As we talk, Trump and Putin are sitting in Japan talking, right? The last time Trump met with Putin, it was in Helsinki, Finland in July last year, not yet a year ago. Do you recall what they said about Trump when he came home? They said he had committed treason
With Putin. They trashed him.
So let me ask you, if they did that simply over a diplomatic protocol, meeting in public and having a joint press conference, and we have a crisis and Trump has to get on the phone with Putin to avert war, will they, the Washington establishment, cry treason?
Yes.
Well, then we're going to war.
Yep.
I think that's
foolish. They will call treason on this.
And they won't allow George and Steve to come in and negotiate a rational exit. It will be, Trump will be thwarted. Putin will have to act the way he's expected to act in Russia, and we will be, or the two nuclear powers will be at war for the first time in history.
And there will be no conventional war with Russia. They're going to pull out the nukes, and so will we. And that's what scares me. Stephen, stay with us. We're going to take a quick break. We'll come back and talk more. We'll take phone calls as well. I told you, folks, this is a very important interview. Dr. Stephen Cohen with us, the professor, his latest book, War with Russia, and we will be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM.